We have done some differentiation so far, and one of our goals now is to define integration over differentiable manifolds. It turns out that we cannot just integrate anything. We can only integrate certain special tensor fields. And they are called differential forms. It's paradoxical that they would be called differential forms given that they are the ones that can be integrated, but that's how it is. So we will now focus on a particular kind of tensor field which is suitable for integration, the so-called differential forms. They're also called exterior differential forms, but in short, just differential forms, and even shorter, just forms. As a preparation, let us consider the cotangent space at the point. Remember what the cotangent space was. It's the dual vector to the tangent space. So every omega, every vector in the cotangent space to the point P is a linear map that takes in tangent vectors and outputs a number. So tangent vector xi goes in, number omega of xi comes out. And we know that that was our terminology, every omega in the cotangent space is a tensor of rank 0, 1, whereas every vector in the tangent space is a tensor of rank 1, 0. Now, let's consider a generalization, namely tensors, a generalization that we've already considered, general tensors. Now let's look at tensors of rank 0, R. So these are tensors that are R-fold covariant and not contravariant at all. These tensors live in the tensor product of cotangent spaces. So any element of the tensor product of R cotangent spaces is a tensor of rank 0, R. And what does it do? Well, since every one of those cotangent spaces contains vectors that are covectors, an element of this entire space over here can take as input R tangent vectors, one for each of these cotangent factors. It takes as input R tangent vectors and outputs a number. In general, you can input any vector in the tensor product of our tangent spaces. So in particular, if we choose R vectors from the tangent space, then any 0 R tensor can take them as input. So any 0 R tensor nu, any R-fold covariant tensor nu, can take these R tangent vectors and map them into a number, namely by feeding them into those tensor factors there. So an R-fold covariant tensor, in general, doesn't have any particular symmetries or anti-symmetries. If you swap two of the inputs, you may or may not get the same thing. You may or may not get a minus sign. You may or may not get something completely different. Just like a general matrix is not necessarily symmetric or anti-symmetric, but is something different. Here, these zero R tensors are in an explicit basis, they would have R different indices, and they may be symmetric or anti-symmetric or none of these under interchange of the indices. But for the purpose of integration, the anti-symmetric part will be super important. Ultimately, the reason is that, as we know from calculus on Rn, Integration involves something antisymmetric, namely, when you integrate in Rn, then you write out an integral in a chart, and as you change chart, as you change coordinates, and I'm just appealing now to your pre-knowledge of calculus on Rn, we haven't covered that here, as you change chart, as you change coordinate system, you get a chain rule factor from the change of chart. And that chain rule factor is the determinant of the Jacobian, of the change of coordinates. And determinants are completely antisymmetric. This is the notion that we need to generalize to general manifolds that don't have to be Rn. And so it's not a surprise that somehow something antisymmetric must be in there. And that's where it arises here. We are looking at zero R tensors, so R-fold covariant tensors, and we will now consider the antisymmetric part of those. So the antisymmetric part of an R-fold covariant tensor nu shall be denoted by nu tilde, and it is nu tilde is the antisymmetric part of nu, and this A, the antisymmetrizer, act in the following way. So we can describe what the antisymmetric part of nu does by explaining what it does for every possible input. So we input now into nu tilde r tangent vectors, and we expect a number out. And the way that the antisymmetric part is defined is this. The antisymmetric part nu tilde feeding on those inputs is, by definition, the antisymmetric part of nu feeding on the same inputs. It's just a naming convention, and this is how it's actually done. We take the original R-fold covariant tensor and we feed it our R tangent vectors, but the labeling of the tangent vectors is now arbitrary. They can be reshuffled. They can be permuted in any arbitrary way. In fact, we do here a sum over all permutations in which the inputs can occur. This is the sum over all sigma in the symmetric group, in the group of permutations of the inputs. So we take our R tangent vectors as inputs, but in all possible permutations. And the prefactor that we put in here is the signature of the permutation. If you go from one particular configuration by a bunch of permutations to another configuration, the relationship between the two is always even or odd. You always need to do either an even number or an odd number of permutations to get there. And that is what the signature does. It counts. Did you have to do an even number or an odd number of permutations? If it's odd, the signature of the permutation is a minus one. So this number is minus one. Otherwise, if it's an even number of permutations, then it's a plus one. So what you see here is that the antisymmetric part of nu acts on our tangent vectors by acting in all, by taking the original R-fold covariant tensor, feeding it the tangent vectors, the R tangent vectors, in any arbitrary sequence, sum all of that up with the appropriate plus and minus signs. And in this way, we generate a lot of terms. How many? R factorial of them. Right? If you take R different objects and you place them into those R slots, then for the first object, you have R choices where to put it. But then one slot is occupied. So for the next one, you have R minus one choices and so on. So overall, there are R factorial combinations. And in order not for these things to blow up, we divide by 1 over R factorial. It's a convention. You could define it otherwise, but then an R factorial would occur at some other place. So this is the number of terms that we have on the right-hand side. So this is the antisymmetric part is the averaged version of the antisymmetrization of the tensor. This is just saying that the antisymmetrization is going to be important later because it will, in a special case, reduce to the antisymmetrization in the determinant from changes of coordinates in Rn. So concretely, let us consider, for example, a 0-2 tensor. So a 0-2 tensor such as this new above. F is some function or function germ. You take the d of it, and that gives you a cotangent vector, if you remember. Okay? And if you take another function germ, take the d of it, that's another cotangent vector. So this is in T1 star, that's in T1 star. The tensor product of the two is in T0, 2. Then that's not necessarily symmetric or anti-symmetric. How does it act? Well, the 0-2 tensor acts on the two inputs psi1, psi2. So if I feed it two tangent vectors, then it will produce as a number this output. You put the first tangent vector into the df, and that's, of course, f applied to, you know, df applied to psi1, which is psi1, which is the directional derivative, applied to f, if you remember how df was defined. And the dg gets fed the psi2, so the dg is evaluated on psi2, that's a number. If you remember how that works, dg of psi2 is psi2, the directional derivative, acting on the function germ g. Be that as it may, the main point is that we see here how that 0-2 tensor acts. Feed it two tangent vectors, and it will give you as output a number. This is a number, and that's a number. Now let's apply the anti-symmetrizer on our 0-2 tensor. Then from the previous slide, we have that the anti-symmetrized 2 tensor, 0-2 tensor, now acts on psi1 and psi2 in this way. It's 1/2, that's the 1 over 2 factorial, because we have just two tensors here. So it's 1/2, and then we have df fed psi1, dg fed psi2, but we have to also swap the two inputs. And that comes with a relative minus sign, because we did one permutation. And so that's the anti-symmetric tensor. So nu tilde acts on psi1 and psi2 in this anti-symmetrized way. And since this is true, this needs to be true for all psi1 and all psi2, we might as well drop writing the psi2, and we have that in the abstract, the anti-symmetrizer acting on this particular 0-2 tensor produces the anti-symmetric linear combination of the two tensors up there with a combinatorial prefactor of 1/2. It turns out that anti-symmetrization is a projector. So if you apply it once on a 0R tensor, then you get an anti-symmetric tensor, and if you apply the A again, nothing changes, you get the same tensor back. It's a projector. And by the way, if we didn't have the 1 over r factorial prefactor, that wouldn't be right, because then we would have some r factorial factor in here. So it is a projector. It maps anti-symmetric covariant tensors into anti-symmetric covariant tensors in such a way that a squared is a. We can check that in the above example. So if we apply the anti-symmetrizer to the anti-symmetrizer, then it's the anti-symmetrizer applied to this, because we just established that this is the anti-symmetrized version of it. So we have that A acts on that, anti-symmetrizes it, gives us this bracket, A acts on that, anti-symmetrizes it and gives us this bracket. And then two of the terms cancel, and we just left with this, which is again A times A applied to that, as it should be. And you see the important thing is that two terms cancel, but two other terms add. And so we have twice as much as we need, but we have a factor of 1/2 in front, and that will kill that, and so we get just this. So now we are ready to define the space of differential R forms, also called exterior R-forms. And that space will be called lambda index r. All of that happening at a point. So these differential R forms are in truth just zero R tensors. So we know these folks already. It's just that they are special ones. They are the ones that are antisymmetric. So we define the space of differential R forms, lambda RP, to be the subspace of all zero R tensors, the subspace which consists of totally antisymmetric tensors of rank 0R. So lambda R of P, the R forms, are a subset of TPR. Actually, the full notation would be a 0 and an R. 0 meaning not contravariant at all, but R tensor factors of cotangent spaces. And the general custom is that when there ought to be a zero here or a zero there, then we just drop that. So the R forms are a subset of the full set of zero R covariant tensors. It's the subset obtained by applying the projector that anti-symmetrizes. So we just take the full space of zero R covariant tensors and we project down onto the anti-symmetric part of that. So whenever we take an element of lambda R of P and we apply the anti-symmetrizer on it, it won't do anything because the elements in here are already anti-symmetric. Applying the anti-symmetrizer on it will not do anything. So if a zero R tensor is in the differential forms, in the set of differential forms, then it is already anti-symmetric, which means that its nu tilde, which is what you get when you apply the anti-symmetrizer, is itself again. Now, what about R equal to zero? We can't anti-symmetrize that. What should that be? And now, by definition, the set of differential zero forms at a point is simply the set of real numbers, by definition. And when we extend this from local to global, when we extend that to differential zero forms on the entire manifold, then this will be simply the space of functions, of scalar functions on the manifold. Because at every point, you can assign a number. So the differential zero forms are just the scalar functions on the manifold, just functions from the manifold into R. What about R equal to 1? If we just have one differential form, if we just have the cotangent space, we can't anti-symmetrize that. So we don't anti-symmetrize this, because we can't. And we simply declare all of the elements of the cotangent space to be differential forms, just by definition. We're just giving names here. This is not theorems. This is nothing deep. It's just giving names to things. So we are saying that the numbers are forming the zero forms. And on the manifold, it's the functions into R that give us the set of zero forms. And then the cotangent vectors, or cotangent vector fields, give us the differential one forms. And we write them as lambda 1, and it's equal to the cotangent space. It's not even a subset. For lambda R, of course, for R larger than 1, it's going to be a subset. We are still nowhere near to be able to integrate. The strategy for now will be this. We define a multiplication for those differential forms. We already have a kind of multiplication for tensors. We need a tensor product. We can just take a tensor and then take the tensor product with another tensor. For example, if we take a 0-1 tensor and take the tensor product with a 0-5 tensor, then we get a 0-6 tensor. Or if we take a tangent vector and a cotangent vector, then we take the tensor product of them and we get a 1-1 tensor. So tensor product we have already trivially. But there is another kind of multiplication that we need to define a multiplication that will not be valid for just arbitrary tensors. We just don't define it for all arbitrary tensors. It will be defined to live only on the space of differential forms. So only the covariant, totally antisymmetric tensors are eligible for this multiplication. This is a multiplication on lambda, on the lambda r's. And by defining this multiplication, we obtain an algebra. We can now multiply differential forms. Once we have that product, we can then multiply differential forms, and that makes them into an algebra, an associative algebra, actually. But it's not the same as the tensor algebra of just writing them together and then having linearity. And once we have an algebra, we can do something that we have exercised before. We can look at the derivations of that algebra. And we get in this way, in an algebraic fashion, notions of differentiation on that algebra. And this way we get the main differentiation, such as the exterior derivative and other things, the inner derivation, all are obtained from this procedure. Define a multiplication specifically for differential forms, obtain an algebra of differential forms, consider then the derivations of that algebra. So what's the multiplication? The multiplication is the wedge product. If omega is an S form, so I spell it out for the last time, an S form is a zero S tensor, so it is not contravariant at all, but it lives in the S-fold tensor product of cotangent spaces, and it's got to be totally antisymmetric. So if omega is one of those, if it's an S form, and nu is an R form, and R and S are not zero, so they're not just, you know, numbers or functions in R, then the wedge product, written in this way, between two differential forms, between those two differential forms, the omega wedge nu, gives us a differential form in the space of R plus S forms. So the wedge product takes in an R form and an S form and produces an R plus S form. And it does it in this way. And it does it in this way. You take the omega and the nu, and the wedge product, omega wedge nu, is by definition what you get when you take the tensor product of omega and nu, and then you anti-symmetrize it. And after you've done that, you multiply with this combinatorial factor. It doesn't have to be this way, but it's super convenient if you use it this way, otherwise you get factorials arise at other places. We still have to explain what the wedge product is between zero forms and S forms, because we excluded R and S equal to zero. And that's easy, because remember what zero forms are at a point, just numbers. And zero forms on the differential manifolds are just scalar functions. So we define that if C is a number in the space of zero forms at a point, and omega is an S form, then the wedge product between the number and the S form is just the product, just ordinary multiplication of a tensor with a number. It's less, C is 5, and it's 5 times that. That is important to keep in mind, because later on, we will sometimes have occasions where we will have like 5 times a differential form. This can also be written as 5 wedge the differential form. That is quite useful to know, because we will later get derivations of the algebra, and they will involve the wedge product. And then, in order to see exactly what's going on, we need to sometimes keep in mind that when we conveniently simply multiply a differential form with a number, we can also write this as the differential form wedge that number, just for the purpose of getting the product rule right later on. So, for example, let's say we take two differential one forms. Remember, that's a cotangent vector, that's a cotangent vector. Then the wedge product between them is obtained by taking the tensor product of them and then anti-symmetrizing it. Right? We had this formula here. The wedge product between two differential forms is given by the tensor product of them, which is then anti-symmetrized and multiplied with this prefactor. Now, in our case, dxi is a one form, dxj is a one form. So these two guys are one forms in this case. So r and s are one. So we have two factorial, and here we have one factorial. So there's an overall factor of two. And here we have the anti-symmetrization of these two. The anti-symmetrization of dxi, dxj gives us this with a prefactor of 1/2. Remember, that was the 1 over r factorial. So 1/2. But we also have a 2 from up here, and that's why there's no prefactor there. So when you take the wedge product between a one form and a one form, this is how it looks like. Now, why would we introduce this wedge product? It will have to do with integration. Remember, that's where we're aiming at. The determinant. So what are the properties of this wedge product that we identified this way? It is bilinear. So if we take omega plus nu, two differential forms, wedge another one, you just get this. So just by the way it's defined, you can easily see that this is the case. But also, if a is a number, then you can shift this number easily from here over there in this way, or you can pull it out of the whole thing. Numbers are really zero forms, but they commute with everything, as we just saw. Again, just plug it into the definitions, and this comes out easily. Also, the wedge product is actually associative. That's not completely obvious. You have to take the tensor product and anti-symmetrize, and then take the tensor product with this and anti-symmetrize. That's the same as doing it in this other way, but it comes out the same. Ultimately, because the end product is simply totally anti-symmetric. Because, for example, whatever the outcome of this is, the wedge product with that is what you obtain when you take the tensor product and then totally anti-symmetrize it. So this has to be totally anti-symmetric, and that has to be totally anti-symmetric, and that's just one of them that it could be. Also, this wedge product, even though it gives us an associative algebra, it's not a commutative algebra. Instead, we have this slightly weird behavior. If omega and nu are differential forms, and we want to interchange their order, we can do that, but we get a minus 1 depending on what R form and S form that is. So if omega is an R form, nu is an S form, then you need to take the product of R and S up here, and that gives you then whether or not they commute or anti-commute. So for example, let's say we have two one forms, a one form here, a one form there. Commuting or anti-commuting? Well, R is 1, S is 1, RS is 1, therefore it's just minus 1 to the power 1. So it's anti-symmetric. It's anti-commuting. But if, for example, you want to commute a one form with a two form, it would be commutative. Again, it's not something that we define here. It just comes out of the definition. It's a consequence. The wedge product derives its main utility from the fact that we can use it to start with the 0 and 1 forms and then multiply them together with the wedge product and get all R forms out of it. So we don't have to create R forms and S forms from scratch. We can build every, for example, find a basis in them. No, we can just start with the 0 forms and the one forms, and then from that we can construct all R-forms. And in particular, if you have a basis of the cotangent space, the basis of the space of one-forms, that is, then that gives you a basis for all of the differential R-forms. So let's say that the theta I, for example, are a bunch of cotangent vectors that form a basis of our cotangent space at the point. So this is n vectors in the cotangent space, so n differential one-forms. For example, the theta I could be such dxi that come with a particular chart. But what we are doing here is not relative to any particular chart. You can just choose any basis vectors, and there you go. So then we can take the wedge product of these basis vectors. So for an n-dimensional manifold, we have n of those. And then we can take the wedge product of these. And a proposition that you may want to prove as an exercise, if you like, a proposition is that if you take all the wedge products of R basis vectors such that the indices are only increasing, then you get a bunch of R forms that together form a basis in the space of R forms. So in practice, let's say we are working on a three-dimensional manifold, and we have three of those thetas. Then what kinds of, let's say we are looking at R2, lambda 2, the space of two forms. How many basis vectors will we get in this way? Well, how many products of two basis vectors, you know, there's nothing else here, just two, because we are just looking at the two forms now. How many basis vectors can be constructed in this way? Well, we could have theta 1 and theta 2. Okay, that's a basis vector. We could have theta 1 and theta 3. That's a basis vector. And we could have theta 2 and theta 3. That's a basis vector. All other combinations would violate that condition that the indices are only increasing. So we would say that, well, it's going to be three of them. And that's indeed the case. There are three basis vectors, the space of two forms in a three-dimensional manifold space of two forms. The space is three-dimensional. What if we look at the space of 100 forms in a three-dimensional manifold? Well, then that would tell us we should write down 100 basis vectors in such a way that the numbers are only increasing up there. That's not possible. In fact, you have to repeat basis vectors as you do it. And you can't anti-symmetrize that. The moment you have more than n basis vectors, if your manifold is n-dimensional, the moment you have a product of more than n basis vectors, some of them must be repeated, and then you can't anti-symmetrize it, and therefore the anti-symmetrization operator will give you zero. So the space of differential forms is of finite dimensions at every point. That's quite different from the space of tensors in general, or even the space of covariant tensors. We can have covariant R tensors with R arbitrarily large. We can just take 100 copies of the cotangent space. So tensor cotangent space, 100 times. And there will be elements of that space, plenty of them. But there aren't anti-symmetric ones, because things must be repeating themselves. So the differential forms are a special, relatively small subset of the space of all covariant tensors. So the dimension then of the space of R forms at a point of an n-dimensional manifold can be shown to be and choose R. And that is because you get to choose out of n basis vectors, R different ones to create your basis vectors. And it would be zero if you have to choose more than you have available. So there are no, on an n-dimensional manifold, there are no n plus one forms, there are no n plus two forms. The highest form there is n forms. So for example, the manifold, let's say, is R3. We choose a point on the manifold, and we choose the basis that most easily comes along with the coordinate system. We choose as a basis in the tangent space, the dx1, dx2, dx3. But the in the cotangent space. But the cotangent space is the space of one forms by definition. So the space of one forms is spanned by these three cotangent vectors. The space of two forms, we just calculated already in our minds, and we found that it is spanned by these three basis vectors. So dx1 wedge dx2, dx1 wedge dx3, dx2 wedge dx3. Notice that the indices are always increasing. And the space of three forms is spanned by the only possibility for writing down the product of three basis vectors without repeating anything. Because if you repeat something, the anti-symmetrization will kill it. And remember that the wedge product always implies total anti-symmetrization. So what we see here is that the space of three forms on a three-dimensional manifold is one-dimensional, just one basis vector. The space of two forms is three-dimensional, space of one forms is three-dimensional, space of zero forms is always one-dimensional. It's just a number, it's just R. By the way, the fact that the space of two forms is three-dimensional for three-dimensional manifolds, you have encountered before. When you studied electromagnetism, you may have heard of pseudo-vectors. And like for the magnetic field. And the point is that you have something that looks like it's a three-component vector in a three-dimensional manifold, and that is all fine. But actually, some of those vectors in electromagnetism are not living in here, but they're living in here. You wouldn't know this easily because they are both three-dimensional vector spaces. But these, of course, from a physicist's definition perspective, transform differently from those, because these are two tensors, these are one tensors. Now in R3, it makes very little difference, it's just a minus sign that occasionally pops up. But in general, of course, these are completely different animals from those ones, so we have to be careful to keep those things apart. Now we have the differential R forms, where R runs from 0 through 1, 2, 3, and so on, all the way to lambda n, where n is the dimension of the manifold, and that's it. There are no higher rank forms. Let us put all the differential forms together into an algebra. So the space of all differential forms is the direct sum of the spaces of the differential R forms from R equals 0 to R equals n. This is something we would not normally do for ordinary tensors. We wouldn't just add a two tensor to a three tensor. So this gives us an algebra structure. We know how to multiply R forms to S forms with a wedge product, namely take the tensor product and then completely anti-symmetrize it and plug a combinatorial prefactor in front of it. So we have a multiplication in that space, but we have also an addition. So the whole thing becomes an associative algebra. And that algebra of all differential forms at a point to manifold is called the exterior algebra, or also the Grassmann algebra, over the tangent space at the point P. I'm saying over the tangent space because that's where all of these things draw their inputs from, because they're all covariant tensors anti-symmetric covariant tensors and linear combinations of them, and they take inputs from here. Now that was all local, and that's useful because then we can count dimensions, it's finite dimensional. Like at a point, the space of differential two forms might be three-dimensional, as we saw for R3. But of course, over the entire manifold, you have the set of differential two-form fields, and that's infinite dimensional. So let's now generalize to fields. A differential form field is a mapping that associates to each point of the manifold an element of the space of differential forms. You see, when there is no index on lambda, it means it could be any kind of form. It's it's just the notation that we introduced just in the previous slide for the algebra of all differential forms. And instead of saying differential form field, one often simply just says differential form, and even the word differential is often dropped, and we just speak of forms. And then these fields form the Grassmann algebra of differential forms. If we look at the entire manifold, we don't just write lambda over P, but lambda over M, the algebra, the associative, non-commutative algebra of differential forms over the manifold. So we achieved one of our goals, which was to define a new algebra. The next aim was to look at the derivations of that algebra. Now, given an algebra, the derivations of the algebra are defined as linear maps that respect the product rule or the Leibniz rule, same thing. Similarly to how we define tangent vectors, which were derivations on the algebra of function germs or functions, now we have this Grassmann algebra, the algebra of differential forms. And for this algebra, we will define two kinds of derivations. In fact, there are many kinds of derivations, but the two most important ones are the so-called exterior differentiation and the so-called inner differentiation. The exterior differentiation is a fascinating object because, as we will see later on, it will concern it's an abstract algebraic concept that will have to do, eventually it boils down to actual derivative taking in a complicated way, but very important for integration and so on. But it has a dual. And that dual, I can't tell you at this moment exactly what the definition of dual is, but let me just tell you that there's a brother of it, of the exterior derivative. And that is entirely geometric, whereas this one is going to be a derivation of an algebra, a completely abstract algebraic object. There is an operation that is dual to this one, which is completely geometric. And that is the operation of taking the boundary. Take a manifold and consider its boundary. So you have, let's say, a two-dimensional manifold. Its boundary might be one-dimensional, like a carpet and the boundary of it, right? Or you take an eggshell, half an eggshell. Then it has an equator. That's the boundary. Right? It's a two-dimensional eggshell, but the equator is a one-dimensional boundary. Or you could have a three-dimensional object, like such as a filled cube, and then its boundary is just these planes. There's a two-dimensional thing. And there is, let me just anticipate that, it's just so much, so fine. this operator, taking the boundary of something, is called the boundary operator. It maps whatever manifold you have into its boundary. What happens if you apply that again? What's the boundary of a boundary? Take the eggshell. Its boundary is going to be the equator. What's the boundary of a circle? It doesn't have one, right? Or take a cube, or let's say a ball, a filled ball. What's its boundary? Well, the boundary of it is going to be the surface of a sphere. It's going to be the sphere, right? But what's the boundary of a sphere? It doesn't have one. And that's a general feature. If you think about it, boundaries don't have boundaries. Which is to say that the boundary operator squared is zero. This thing, the exterior derivative, will be the co-boundary operator, the dual of it. It too will have the property that if you apply it twice, it's zero. But for completely different reasons. And there's going to be a theorem that relates the two to each other that show that one is the dual of the other. Anyway, so we have an associative algebra here, and we want to define two derivations on it. The exterior derivation, which is going to be a little magical, and the inner derivation, which is going to be just a letdown. I mean, it's really a very simple thing, but important. Okay, so the definition is that whenever we have a linear map from our Grassmann algebra of differential forms into the Grassmann algebra of differential forms, which obeys these two conditions, then we call it a derivation of degree k. A derivation of the algebra of degree k. And the definition is that this linear map should map the differential forms into the differential forms in such a way that it maps S forms into S plus K forms. So if our map is, of our derivation, is mapping two forms into five forms, and is mapping three forms into six forms, and seven forms into 10 forms, and so on, always plus three, then it might be a derivation of degree three. If it is a derivation, we also still have to check this. And that's, of course, the key. In order to qualify phi, for phi to qualify to be called a derivation, it must also obey the condition that when you apply it to alpha, veg, beta, then just as if you were differentiating, it should be the derivation applied to the first factor, veg, the second factor left invariant, plus leaving the first factor invariant and then, in quotation marks, differentiating the second factor, right? It's just like a product rule, just like a Leibniz rule. So a phi is called a derivation if it obeys the Leibniz rule. The overall philosophy of that is that Newton and Leibniz defined differentiation in terms of limit taking. But really, the product rule, which is usually presented as a consequence, can also be used as the starting point to define what we mean by differentiation. And that's what we do here. So we call a linear map a derivation of the algebra if it obeys the Leibniz rule, and it's called of degree k if it increases the degree of the differential form that it acts on by k. We will also allow k to be negative. We could have a derivation that reduces the degree of the differential form, or k could even be zero. There are many different derivations. And then there are also antiderivations. A linear map of on the space of differential forms is called an antiderivation of degree k if it again changes the degree by k. But now the Leibniz rule is a little bit modified. It takes two differential forms, alpha and beta, and maps them into something that looks like the product rule is obeyed, except that there might be a minus sign here. It depends on what the degree is of the first of the two differential forms, this one. If this is a Q form, so it's a Q-fold covariant totally antisymmetric tensor, then we have to take here minus 1 to the power Q. So these are antiderivations. And this is then called the anti-Leibniz rule. Remember, it doesn't mean that there's always a minus sign. It's only when the first factor is an odd form. So it's a one form, three form, five form, and so on. And here's an important proposition, which we will show constructively to be true. Given this definition of derivations and antiderivations, it is a fact that if we want to define a new derivation or antiderivation, then it suffices to define what it does on zero forms and what it does on a basis of one forms. If you know that, then you can already, from the axioms, derive what your derivation or antiderivation does on any arbitrary R forms. And the reason is simply this. If you have an arbitrary R form and you want to know what the derivation does on it, well, you write your R form as a product of smaller forms, like an A form and a B form, with such that A plus B is R, right? And then you use the derivation property, the Leibniz rule, to reduce calculating the derivation on the R form to calculating the derivation on the A form and the B form, which you can then again split and split and split until eventually you just need to know what the derivation what it does on zero forms and on one form. So in order to define a derivation, we only need to fix what it does on zero forms and one forms, and then by using the axioms of the derivation, the action will be extended to all differential forms. So let's start with the famous exterior derivative, the one that has as its brother the co-boundary, the boundary operator. This will be the boundary operator. So this will be the co-boundary operator, and the boundary operator is its dual. So the exterior derivative, D, is mapping differential forms into differential forms, and we define it to be an antiderivation, an antiderivation of degree k equal 1. We define it in this way. So D is supposed to take differential forms, differential zero forms, which is to say functions, and map them into cotangent vectors. And D is also, concretely, it is supposed to map functions into DF. This is nice because it extends the notation and terminology that we've already used previously. Remember, we said that for every function f, we can write down a cotangent vector, namely df. For example, for the coordinate functions xi, we have the basis of the cotangent space of the dxi. So we already had the d, which did already their job, and it was this d here. So we already have defined the map d earlier. I hope you remember all how that went. It mapped functions into cotangent vectors, functions f into df, the df as we defined it earlier. Remember how df, how the cotangent vector acts on a tangent vector? If you have a tangent vector xi, how does this act on it? So df applied to tangent vector xi is, by definition, xi acting on f. F is a function, xi is a directional derivative. That's what it does, right? So this is how we define the df. Okay, so that's the definition here, right? Functions mapped into zero forms mapped into one forms. Function mapped into cotangent space. Same as saying that zero forms get mapped into one forms. That's what we needed for a k equal 1 derivation, right? The exterior derivative is a derivation of degree k equal to 1. Where is it? K equal to 1. It changes the degree of the differential form by 1. So from zero forms to one forms. Right. Okay. And secondly, we have to identify or specify how we want our D to act on a basis of one form. Well, while we're at it, we might as well specify how the D acts on the basis of one forms here. And we define the action to be simply to map them into zero. A very innocent step at this point. But it's crucial because this is the analog, this is the brother of the statement that the boundary of a boundary is empty. Boundaries don't have boundaries. It's not obvious at this point, but this is where it will, this is setting the scene for this to come out. Okay, so it's as simple as it gets. We just recycle the D that we had earlier to define the action on zero forms, and then we say that the action on the basis of one forms is simply that it maps them onto zero. This, by the way, does not mean that D maps all one forms to zero. Yeah, be careful. It just means that it maps these one forms to zero. Doesn't map all of them to zero. For example, let's say we multiply dxi with a zero form, which is some function f of x. Okay, so now we have f of x times dxi. This is the same as saying it's f of x veg dxi. Remember? If you take a function and multiply it, veg product it with a form, you can put the veg product or not put it, it's the same thing by definition. So if I multiply here some f of x, then this thing is actually becoming space dependent. And now if I want to apply the D on that, I really have to apply it on the veg product of a function, veg dxi, and I have to use the Leibniz rule to do so. And then I will get a term where the D acts on the F, leaving this the same, and a term where the prefactor F is left the same, and the D acts on that. That second term goes away because we have D acting on D, right? But the first term where the D acts on the F survives, and then we have df veg dxi. So this is not to say that D maps all one forms to zero. No, no, no. It just maps these particular ones to zero. Okay, and now we can calculate that in a chart. So we had that D is mapping zero forms into one forms in the following way. The df of x is df by dxi dxi. We proved this two lectures back. Right, so these are the coefficients in this basis. The dxi form a basis of the cotangent space, and these are the coefficient numbers, and we calculated them earlier. And now we have more generally this. Take this differential form. So you take a few of those basis vectors and take the veg product between them. And if you take S of them, then this is an S form. Made out of one forms, made out of S one forms by veg product. And then let's say we have some coefficient functions in front, just as we discussed the f of x possibility in the previous slide. So what we have is still an S form, because this is just coefficient functions. So these guys are all just zero forms, just numbers. At every point there, just numbers. Lots of them, but numbers. And this is an S form. The veg product between a zero form and an S form is still an S form. And remember, here's again this thing that we can write in veg here, but traditionally, we can also write this just with a blank. Ordinary multiplication is veg multiplication if one of the two factors is just a number. So then, how do we carry out the action of D, of the exterior derivative, on such a generic S form? See, all S forms can be written in this form, because these guys form a basis in the space of S forms, summing over all the permutations of the I and the S, such that the indices are increasing. And these are the coefficients, arbitrary coefficients, all the basis vectors, you get all of the differential S forms in this way. How is the action of D, exterior derivative, on that? Well, the D acting on our generic S form is given by this. By the Leibniz rule, we have the D acting on the lambda zero, leaving all of that the same, plus or minus, because it's an antiderivation, the axial derivative is an antiderivation, where you leave that one alone, and this remains the same. And this becomes differentiated. So let's write it out. We have the d beta, and the first action is that it acts on these number-valued functions, so zero forms, by doing the usual thing, d beta by dxi, dxj. This is what we just had here. If you take a function, in our case it's the coefficient function for each fixed I1 to ij, if you take a function, you apply the d to it, so it's a zero form, you apply the d to it, you get a one form, and that one form is given by the partial derivatives multiplied with the basis vectors. So we do exactly this here, and don't get distracted by the fact that this thing has indices and think that it's a tensor or something like that. No. This is the zero form. Okay, it's just a function. The one forms are here, and the whole thing is an S form. This whole thing is just the zero form. So d beta by dxj, and then dxj, this is the differential form that we obtain when we apply d to that function. And then we have the veg of all the rest, which stays the same. And then we have terms where this is not differentiated, where the exterior derivative doesn't act on that, but instead it leaves it the same, and it multiplies with the d of terms over here. But when the d acts on terms like over here, then it's a d squared. It's a d acting on the dxi, but we define that this is zero. So all those extra terms go away, and that's all that's left, which is still totally anti-symmetric, because remember, that's what you get when you take the wedge product. The end result is, you take the tensor product and then totally anti-symmetrize it. So the whole thing is totally anti-symmetric. It's an S plus one form now, because if you look carefully, we get still the old basis vectors plus a new one from having differentiated this thing. So the degree of our S form went up to S plus one. So now we can make and prove the proposition that the D acting on the entire Grassmann algebra has the property that when you apply it twice, it's zero. It's not just on the basis vectors of the coordinate functions that it has this property, but when you apply D twice on whatever differential form, it always is zero. So to prove that, let's just take what we just calculated, namely what the action of D is on a differential form beta, and then apply the D again. So now we have to differentiate this, leaving all this the same, plus leaving that factor the same, differentiating these guys. But that latter term goes away again, of course, because the D on any one of those vanishes. So we get the second derivative here. And now, for purely algebraic reasons, see, it has nothing to do with geometry, because this is always symmetric in those two derivatives. And that is always anti-symmetric in the indices. We must have that the whole thing vanishes. Don't need to calculate the details. This is symmetric in J and K. That is anti-symmetric, so it has to vanish. And so what we see here is that this operator D, applied onto a differential form, gets something non-zero, but applied again, it will always be zero. That property follows for simple algebraic reasons. Symmetry here, anti-symmetry there. But as we will later see, this thing has a brother, the boundary operator, which also has a property that when you take it twice, and you find that the boundary of a boundary vanishes, it also has this property. And I just find it fascinating how something algebraic like this is so deeply connected to something geometric as well. So for example then, when we have, let's say, manifolds R3, we have that the DFs are given by in this expression as we discussed earlier. And then this would be defined to be the gradient field, for example, in electromagnetism. And the electric field, for example, is obtained as the exterior derivative of the electrostatic potential. Okay, now let's assume that we take a one form, which is an arbitrary but not necessarily gradient, and therefore not necessarily gradient covariant vector field. So we have that our one form is some coefficient functions multiplied with those basis vectors here. Every one form can be written in this way, because these guys are a basis, and these are just the space or space-time dependent coefficients in that basis to designate what one form we're dealing with at every point x. So then, if we take the D of this one form, we obtain some image of the exterior derivative under that action. And it's obtained in the following way. We take the coefficient function, differentiate it, and leave the rest invariant, plus other terms where we are differentiating, where we leave that the same and differentiate that, but that's going away. So we have just these terms. So we have this, but because it's anti-symmetric, we can also write it in this way. So instead of summing over all I and j, we can write two terms with the I and the j's interchanged, and then just sum with the I and the j in a particular order. This is all happening in R3. Let's spell it out what this sum is, and we get this. You recognize that, you see, we started with a one form. The d of that must be a two form. And this two form is, as we just calculated, by writing out what this sum explicitly is, we see that it's this basis vector of in the space of two forms times that factor, this basis vector in the space of two forms times that factor, and this is the third basis vector times this factor. And remember, we saw earlier that in R3, the space of two forms is three-dimensional, which is why in R3, the space of two forms can easily be mistaken to be a vector space of tangent vectors or cotangent vectors. And that's what we see here. Here are the three components in the three basis, with respect to the three basis vectors of the space of two forms in R3. And these three components are, if you think back to your classes in electromagnetism, simply the curl of a vector field, a cotangent vector field. So this is what would have been called the curl. But now we see that the curl is just a special case. It's just the d, the exterior derivative of a one form. And it is called a pseudo-vector because it doesn't really transform under changes of charge like you would expect. And of course, from a completely abstract perspective, it's not at all a tangent or cotangent vector. It is a two form. That's why it transforms in a funny way. So gradient vector fields are curl-free, and this is a special case, if you remember that from electromagnetism. If you take, for example, an electrostatic potential, calculate the gradient to get the electric field, and then calculate the curl of the electric field, you would come out to be zero. Gradient vector fields are curl-free, and now we see why that is. It is because the gradient to a function is the one form that you get by applying d to it. And then if you do another d on that to get the curl, you get d squared on a function, that's zero. So we see that d squared being zero on differential forms tells us immediately that the curl of gradients is vanishing. But it's all very special for three-dimensional, right? I mean, this is always for all dimensions, but this is very special for three dimensions. Because only in three dimensions is it the case that the space of two forms has the same dimension as the space of one form. Right. Okay, now, we are almost out of time. A differential form, this is already, what I'm telling you now, already has to do with integration in an indirect way. You see, if you take an ordinary function, then you can ask, can I integrate that? Can I find the antiderivative of this? And sometimes you may, sometimes you may not. But you know that in principle it exists. It may not be expressible in terms of elementary functions, but it exists in one dimension. But you see, in n dimensions, that's not so. Let us look at this. A differential form omega is called closed if the d of it is vanishing. For example, if omega is itself the d nu of a nu, then we have d squared nu, and that's vanishing. So there definitely are differential forms which are closed. So for example, any beta which is a d of a gamma is closed. But then another definition is that a differential form omega is called exact if it kind of has an antiderivative. So an omega is called exact if there exists a differential form of which it is the exterior derivative. Right? So we can ask, is omega exact? This is to say, does it have an antiderivative? Is it the d of something? Now, sometimes that will happen. Of course, you can just take a nu and take the d to it, and then you get an omega, and that has the nu as its antiderivative, right? So that certainly happens sometimes. But how general are these definitions? How does closeness and exactness, what do they have to do with each other? Now, this actually depends on the global topology of the manifold. In the simplest case, let's say that the manifold is contractible. So that means that the manifold has, let's say, this shape. Everything hangs together, and there's no hole, and this is the point x0. I'm just singling out some arbitrary point. Then, if there exists a continuous map which contracts that manifold down to the point x0, any point x0, then we say that it is contractible. On the other hand, if the manifold looks like this and it has a hole in it, then there is no continuous map that would allow me to contract that manifold into just a point. At some point, I would have to cut and do something discontinuous. So it turns out that one can prove the so-called Poincaré lemma, which says that if a manifold is contractible, so it doesn't have these holes, then a differential form is exact if and only if it is closed. So that means if I want to know whether or not it has an antiderivative in the differential form sense, then, which can be very hard, you have, it's just like integration. You have to check, is there not a function of which my gamma is the d? Instead, on a contractible manifold, you can do something much simpler, which is you can check whether gamma is closed. So you just apply the d to it, calculate d gamma. And if that's zero, then it's called closed. And you can conclude that the gamma is exact. It has an antiderivative. So on contractible manifolds, you can check for the existence of the antiderivative by checking whether d of gamma is zero. But that's not so when the manifold is not contractible. And that's interesting because this is an algebraic test. And it's very difficult to get hold of the geometry of a manifold once it is in dimensions higher than 3. Let's say you have a manifold of solutions to a differential equation. And the manifold is 27 dimensional. So if a 27-dimensional manifold of solutions of the space of differential equation, and you want to know whether that space of solutions, that manifold of solutions, has holes or not. Can you contract it to a point or not? Does it have holes? And what you can do is you can check whether there's a difference between exact and closed forms. If there are forms that are closed but not exact, then you know that the manifold is having a hole somewhere. You see, if it is exact, then you can always conclude that it must be closed. Because if it's exact, the gamma is a D nu. And therefore, if you apply another D to it, it will be closed. It will be zero. So exactness always implies closeness. But closeness implies exactness only if the manifold is contractible. And what that means is that we are at the beginning of a theory that tries to classify the global topology of a manifold, holes, handles, and so on. Now, space-time probably doesn't have holes, but we don't know. It might have holes or handles, but the mathematics of holes and handles and manifolds comes up, for example, in gauge theories and in string theory and so on. So if you like, I mean, we are actually out of time, but we have, if you like, the next 5 minutes, I will give you a look at the bigger picture of all of those things. Is that okay? Okay, it's like it's a bonus thing, right? It's not part of GR necessarily. Okay, let's look at the bigger picture. This method for checking for the global shape of a manifold. Does it have holes or handles? That method is a special case of a cohomology theory, and it is called the Dirac cohomology. So what is the Dirac cohomology theory? Well, more generally, we wanted the bigger picture. You see, the Dirac cohomology theory is simply check whether there are closed differential forms that are not exact, that don't have an antiderivative. So if that exists, if you find a differential form whose D is vanishing, the D applied to the differential form is vanishing, but it is not itself the D of something, then the manifold must have a hole. That's the essence of what Dirac cohomology is doing. But what is this thing, cohomology theory? What is a cohomology theory and what other cohomology theories exist? So a cohomology theory is a map, let's call it C, from the set of differentiable manifolds into the set of commutative groups. Why would we be interested in such a map? Well, differentiable manifolds are complicated, especially if they're higher dimensional, when we can no longer visualize them. And it would be very difficult to even work with coordinate systems. It just can be super complicated. Now, if we can map them into something much simpler, such as commutative or abelian groups, then there's a chance that if we want to compare these things, which are very difficult to compare, if this map is faithful, then we can compare instead these much simpler objects, commutative groups, abelian groups. So we want a map from the space of differentiable manifolds into the space of abelian groups, such that if the abelian groups are not isomorphic to each other, then the manifolds cannot be isomorphic either. So we want that if two differentiable manifolds are isomorphic, then the abelian groups that they map onto also need to be isomorphic. This is not one-to-one. You see that it only works in one direction, right? I just negated a statement. So we want that if they are the same here, they must be the same there. If they are different there, they must be different there. Same statement. It doesn't mean that if they are the same here, they must be the same there. See that? Okay. So it's only partial classification, and so far no complete classification exists. But that's the problem of cohomology. So why are cohomology theories useful? Well, it's much easier to check whether two abelian groups, the images of these complicated differential manifolds in abelian groups, it's much easier to check if two abelian groups are isomorphic than to check if two differential manifolds are diffeomorphic. So what are the abelian groups in the case of the Ram cohomology? We are supposed to have done already one of those cohomologies. Well, the abelian groups in the case of the Ram cohomology, they are the vector spaces of closed but not exact differential forms. Right? Vector space is a group, among other things, because you can always add vectors. And for every vector, there's an inverse, there's a neutral element, a zero vector, and so on. So vector spaces are abelian groups. And so what we can do is we can take the differentiable form, the differentiable manifold, and then map it into the space of closed but not exact differential forms, closed but not exact differential R forms for each R. And so we get an abelian group for each one of the choices of R. All right. And one can show that this is true, that if you have two manifolds that are diffeomorphic, so there's an isomorphism between them, differentiable isomorphism, then the vector spaces of closed but not exact forms are isomorphic as well. So you can use it for classification. It's not a complete classification. Some things will escape. Some manifolds will map into the same abelian groups without being the same manifolds. But any two manifolds that map into different abelian groups guaranteed are not the same manifolds. So let's look at the even bigger picture now. We have now a hint of cohomology theories, but what are cohomology theories examples of? Okay, so all cohomology theories are, to simplify things, roughly speaking, they are so-called natural transformations between two categories. And in a way, we are reaching the pinnacle of mathematics here, as far as we know it today, in terms of how abstract things can get. So what is a category? A category consists of a set of objects, and I drew here those dots to indicate objects. So a category is a set of objects. But not just objects. We need that there are arrows between those objects, an arrow to the object back to itself. And also we require some simple axioms. For example, if there's an arrow from this object to that object, and an arrow from that object to this object, then there must be an arrow also from this object to that object. Nothing specified about what those arrows mean, but it's got to be there. And we want associativity. We want that every dot has a map, has not a map, an arrow that goes back to itself, and so on. There's a bunch of axioms that you may want to look up some point, but I have already almost mentioned all of the axioms for categories. So it's a very simple thing. You have objects and you have arrows in between them, and those arrows are called morphisms. The point about these definitions is that it's super general. For example, let's consider the category of vector spaces. In this case, each dot here is a vector space. Each object is a vector space. And the morphisms are linear maps. And clearly, if you have from this vector space to that vector space a linear map, and from here to this one, then there must exist a linear map from this one to that one as well. So that axiom is fine. Also, there are always linear maps from a vector space into itself, etc. So we can look at the category of vector spaces. Objects are vector spaces, morphisms are linear transformations. Then let's look at another category, category of associative algebras. So each point in here is an associative algebra. And the objects are associative algebras, the morphisms are algebra homomorphisms, are maps between one algebra and the other algebra such that it doesn't matter whether you first multiply or add two elements of the algebra and then map, or you first map the ingredients and then multiply or add them later. Algebra homomorphisms. And so on. You can define the category of rings, categories of modules, or whatever algebraic object you might want to consider. Basically, anything in mathematics can be put into this form of having structures, such as vector spaces or algebras, and they form the objects. And then the arrows are maps that preserve that structure. for example, topological spaces. You have the continuous maps in between that preserve the topologies. So you can look at all sorts of mathematical structures. The objects are defined by certain axioms, and then you have the morphisms that preserve the structure. But then you can also look at the category of categories. Right? So now every dot in here is a category. Like, this could be the category of, I don't know, non-abelian groups. And this could be the category of topological spaces, and this one is topology of, this is the category of differentiable manifolds, and so on. So the objects are categories, and the morphisms are structure-preserving maps, so-called natural transformations. So for the category of categories, the maps, the morphisms between the objects have a particular name, and they are called natural transformations. We've already discussed one, as you will see in a moment. So now, a cohomology theory is a natural transformation. Namely, consider, in the above picture, category of categories, one of these dots is the category of differentiable manifolds, and another one of these dots is the category of abelian groups. And then we are looking at an arrow from the differentiable manifolds category to the abelian groups category. An arrow which preserves the structure, which is exactly what we wanted. We wanted that we have a map from differentiable manifolds into abelian groups such that if the manifolds are different, the groups better be different. So it has to preserve at least that structure going from here to here. So a cohomology theory is one of those natural transformations, is one of those arrows in the category of categories. It maps from one category to another category. In this case, in order to be called a cohomology theory, it's mapping from the category of differentiable manifolds into the category of abelian groups. And so if this is the category of differentiable manifolds, this is the category of abelian groups, then we have that here in this category of differential manifolds, here's an object, that's one manifold, another object is another manifold, a diffeomorphism is mapping in between them. Morphism, in this case, is a diffeomorphism. And the natural transformation is a map that maps everything on the left to something on the right. It maps this manifold into this abelian group, that manifold into that abelian group, maps the diffeomorphism into a group homomorphism. And as we said, the group on this side, the abelian group on this side, is a vector space. For the case of the round cohomology that we covered already, it's the vector space of closed differential forms that are not exact. So differential forms whose D is vanishing, but that are not themselves the D of some other differential form. Right, and so if we set these things up properly, then, I mean, if all of these things are obeyed, then if the group M is not homomorph to the group N, there should be, I mean, it's the image of N, the group that's the image of M, if that's not related by group homomorphism to the group that's the image of N, then the two differentiable manifolds cannot be related by a diffeomorphism, so they really are different. And this is actually not just some application of category theory, it is the original application of category theory. Nowadays, category theory is used to bring structure into anything in mathematics, but originally it was in order to tackle the hard problem of classifying manifolds in terms of holes and handles and so on. And another, two slides very quickly, just to give you a flavor of another cohomology theory. So another natural transformation from the category of differentiable manifolds into the category of abelian groups is K-theory. We're really so late already. OK, so this cohomology theory uses the fact that on a contractible manifold, there is only one way that you can put a vector bundle on the manifold. So this has nothing to do with differential forms now. The cohomology theories are not tied to differential forms. Cohomology theories could be anything that maps from a differential manifold into abelian groups. So it sort of produces a simplified image of the manifold in the abelian groups. And this theory, K theory, which for a time was very popular in string theory, K theory starts with the observation that, again, there's something special about contractible manifolds. And that is that when a manifold is contractible, then there's only one way to put a tangent bundle on it. However, if it's not, there can be many different tangent bundles that can be put on a manifold. And in particular, and I think we had this earlier, this picture, if your manifold has a hole in it, then you can have non-trivial tangent bundles. And basically, the idea with K-theory is that you identify non-trivial global topology of the manifold, and not topology in the sense of open neighborhoods, but in this topology in the sense of holes and handles. You can determine or you can learn something about the non-trivial topology of a manifold by studying the structure of its tangent bundles. And it turns out that tangent bundles can be added. You can take the direct sum. You have a tangent bundle and another tangent bundle. You take the direct sum of the two, also gives you a tangent bundle. And that is almost as good as a group, except what's the inverse? You know, for the tensor product of vector spaces, we usually don't have an inverse. We just can add another few dimensions, but how can you subtract dimensions? But that's what you need in order to get an abelian group, because you always need an inverse. But that's just a technicality that can be overcome by a trick that Whitney introduced. Did I write it somewhere? Whitney's generalization. There's a generalization of the direct sum of vector spaces and vector bundles. And with that, the space of, oh my God. And with that, the space of, I'm very sorry, that's my phone. So this the space of differential, now I'm a little confused. Okay, so the space of tangent bundles becomes an abelian group with respect to the generalization of the direct sum of Whitney, and therefore we have, again, a cohomology theory, a map from the space of from the set or the category of differential manifolds into that of abelian groups, and it turns out that it characterizes or classifies differential manifolds slightly differently from how the Ramm cohomology does it. Still, we don't have anything, any cohomology that would be fail-proof. So it can always still happen. I mean, there are several other cohomology theories like cobordism and so on. And they can all distinguish certain manifolds, but there are still some manifolds that cannot be distinguished by the known cohomology theories. But if, for example, you want to do quantum gravity, and you want to allow space-time to fluctuate in such a way that it produces arbitrary foam-like structures at the Planck scale, then you need to do a sum over all possible topologies, over all possible configurations of holes and handles, if this is how nature operates. Then it would be nice to have a complete classification so that we can write down a path integral or sum over all possibilities in this way. So far, we don't have it. That's as far as one gets so far. See you on Friday.